We will take our first question from Michael Huttner from J.P. Morgan.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of questions. On the German motor, can you give a bit more color as to what is happening in the market? There were I remember seeing a newspaper article saying, oh, rates are rising, etc. Clearly they're not. The second, can you say what is in the actual revenue numbers in terms of price rises? So I understand the number of 2.2%, which is the renewal rate, so you know that has to be earned over a full year, doesn't apply to all the portfolio, etc. What was the actual figure included in Q1? Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Michael, good afternoon. Two questions you had, German motor price development and what was the revenue impact. We've given the waterfall. I think that's very important in how it has been affected. We believe that the price effect was, and let me start with the second question, overall on the portfolio, plus 20 basis points. Yeah, plus 20 basis points, and we had a negative volume effect that was 30 basis points. So that's the overall impact on the portfolio. Now, German motor is up for grabs. There's lots of stories around what the future holds. I'm more conservative than many market observers because I just look at the level of excess capital that we have in the German P&C industry. This is huge, particularly for those that don't really have shareholders, whether that's the public insurers or the mutuals. So some of them even have the desire to use that capital up. So I don't expect dramatic price increases in motors anytime soon, despite the fact that there are a number of competitors losing money significantly. Second observation, the overall P&C market is running below 100, and that's also not a sign that gives support to motor pricing because people can still cross-subsidize from other lines of businesses. That is the reason why we stay extremely conservative, and in difference to many years back, you know, I had some journalist questions in the morning, we will focus on margins, we'll let volume go if required.
Thank you very much.
We will take our next question from William Morgan from Goldman Sachs.
Good afternoon. I have two questions, please. The first one relates to kind of following on from Michael's question, actually, and the price increases you talk about in your on slide 22. If only 20 basis points is being earned through in the first quarter, I find that very difficult to reconcile with the numbers you're showing on slide 22, given that, you know, if I look back at presentations you did last year, you were still looking at price increases of north of 1%, I think. So I'm surprised that you're only earning through 20 basis points in the first quarter. Could you possibly explain why that is? And related to that, you do sort of talk a lot about discounting impacts. Are these perhaps these increases at renewals, et cetera, that you're showing here, maybe not including the impacts of discounting that's going on at the agent level? The second question I have relates to your slide on the expenses that you give on page 19. I read somewhere this morning that there has been a slight change in allocation between the admin expenses and other acquisition expenses in the first quarter of 2010. But even if I ignore that, if I assume that other acquisition expenses are development in the business and admin expenses are obviously ongoing costs, you know, you're still looking at around a sort of 7% year-on-year increase, given that your top line is essentially progressing at flat, then presumably that is going to start impacting your combined ratio quite significantly. And especially if you're only earning 20 basis points through of price increases with claims inflation going the other side, I struggle to sort of see how your combined ratio isn't getting significantly worse over time. Thanks.
Good questions. Now, the first thing is on the last year forecast. That is obviously always before effective discounts, and it takes about two quarters to figure out really how the renewal gets priced into the portfolio, even though we've become extremely restrictive on the use of those discounts. And then this is the first question. The second question is on the distribution cost. This is a little bit of fixed cost effect, and it's not true, by the way, that the top line has not been growing, right? So if you look over a number of quarters, we have been having volatile numbers, but the relative effects have been almost equal. Now, you are absolutely right. We cannot have a continuous increase in non-commission distribution cost, particularly on the investment cost, if revenues are not coming or a better loss ratio. By the way, that's the other side of the coin. You can invest in distribution and make sure you get better risk than the market, and that is very well invested distribution cost. So we are watching this extremely carefully. But let me remind you, there are a couple of investments involved that we've been talking about in the last quarter of last year, and Michael Diekmann has talked about. The first one is we're building up a global automotive platform in order to systematically rebase our motor distribution. Most of the new business in the future, the truly new business in motor, is going to go through car dealers and OEMs, and we want to be and continue our market leadership position. So we're building that. For the first time in many years, we have been net growing our distribution capacity on the agency side in Germany, and we invested significant amounts of money there. And in Fireman's Fund in the U.S., we mentioned to you we've invested a lot of money in technology in order to grow the business and grab market share. So these investments are partially reflected in the numbers, but you are right. We need to make sure that we see the revenue and the price effects coming through this year, but we are committed to make the plan that we've given ourselves.
I mean, if I could possibly follow up on this, I mean, effectively, you're saying that the price increases you're showing at renewals are not including the effect of discounting. I mean, if we start to think about the impact, I mean, if you look at the market overall and just stand back from the data and just say, well, you know, given what I know about claims inflation, given what I can see is happening to the nominal pricing and what is actually feeding through into the revenue line, I mean, if we ignore expenses for the moment, I mean, when you look at the loss ratio, would you expect that to actually be improving with this pricing data you're showing? Or would you expect it to be broadly stable? Or would you actually expect a slight deterioration going forward, given?
I think we have to have an improvement. And that's why, please differentiate the renewals. Not all of the business is renewing, right? We have still contracts running 4 to 5 years, where the nominal tariff increases we are providing on page 22, which is at the highest number that we've had in many years now, 3.2%, have to come through. Now, what you're absolutely right, we need to see them in the book. Yeah, so they have to be effective. They need to take care of bonus malus, which we do compute in here, and they need to be actually giving into the book. The key uncertainty, by the way, I see in a completely different area, well, that is price increases have to be seen in light of lapses, right? So because in highly competitive market, when you push price increases, some of the risks that you reprieve price might actually leave the portfolio, and that we will see only over the course of the year. At this point in time, I, however, think the combination of the two points that we have here should support the target combined ratio that we've been shooting for. That is before NatCat.
Okay, thanks very much.
We'll take our next question from Fabrizio Croce from Kepler.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much. If I think to your government bond exposure, and if I add the 28 billion that you have in terms of gross exposure for Italy, I end up to one-time gross exposure in proportion to equity. Now, if I net this for the policyholder and shareholder share, I end up to some 29% exposure on equity, in a worst-case scenario, of course. Now, the question is, however, when push comes to show, so the situation becomes serious, then probably the policyholder-shareholder split won't work exactly as it should. And therefore, what is actually the effective exposure if guarantees kicks in as well? That's my first one. My second one is in terms of distribution costs, which you said to be you are looking to lower them. So the question is, in a competitive market like a German one, does this not equal to cutting your own leg before a race, actually? And would it not make more sense to work actually on the back office and cutting there the costs?
Let me start with the second question because I think that's more easy to answer. You know, I've this question that you gave to me, and I have a lot of respect for you, sounds a little bit like Roland Emmerich 2012. Anybody can make up his or her favorite doomsday scenario, but I don't believe, to be honest, in a doomsday scenario. If Italy goes bust, we have very different problems to worry about other than policyholder participation. That's my point of view. That doesn't mean we don't manage risks very, very carefully, particularly around peripheral exposures, because that's a much more likely scenario that something is going to happen. And as I said before, we are monitoring that very carefully. Now, by the way, that sort of net exposure perspective, I particularly personally do not find helpful, because policyholder participation is, by the way, as you said it, is very unclear and gets determined at the end of any annual year. What is really the right measure is what is the gross exposure, and if we have to impair our positions, what is the hit to the P&L that we would have to take? Yeah, and in the case of Greece, that number can, that by the way fluctuates over time, can be anywhere between 300 and 400 million net, and I think we can very easily sustain such a hit. Yeah, so we feel very comfortable with our overall exposure. Now, the other point is on Germany. The German expense ratio has actually improved from 28% in the first quarter of 2009 to 27.7% in the first quarter of 2010. Yeah, so we're working on it. We're working on the back office. We're doing exactly what you say. On the distribution side, again, it's significantly driven by investment. So the question really is, should we continue to invest in new distribution formats or should we not? Is this the right timing to support and prepare ourselves for the new world, or should we curtail investments? And we're keeping a close eye on it, let's be assured. And I think there's more homework to be done, but we will manage those investments very carefully. All right, next question, please.
We will now move to Andrew Broadfield from Morgan Stanley.
Oh, good afternoon. Just two questions, please. One, I was wondering, you've spoken a little bit about the investment in the distribution, I think you said particularly in Germany. I was wondering whether you might be able to just give us a little bit more granularity about exactly what that is and how you intend to, or when and how you expect that to deliver either top line or bottom line benefits. So just a little bit more granularity in exactly what you're doing there. And I was also interested by your comment on the claims inflation you were talking about. You're saying that, you know, at the beginning of the year you already priced that into the claims, but it takes a little while for it to come through on the premium. That sounded slightly, I think, if I understood it correctly, it sounded a little misleading, because all it's telling you is that it wasn't priced into the premium last year, which is the premium we're earning this year, and the claims matching that have an inflationary component. So I was just trying to understand whether there's something, some accounting thing that I'd missed there, or whether it's just what I've just explained, described.
Yeah, it's not misleading. Let me give you an example. In the fourth quarter, Italy is very as a good example here. In the fourth quarter of last year, we got new tables for compensating bodily injured claims. Yeah, they were called the Milan tables. We were the first, and by the way, the only company in the fourth quarter of last year of already adopting our reserving and claim settlement policy to that new legal environment, which dramatically, in some cases, doubled the amount of that you have to reserve and pay out to your claimants. A lot of companies only do that when they have to pay, and that often creates intra-book negative runoff. So we are very conservative and then increase the reserves where we already know that they govern. By the way, because that pushes then also pressure on the front office to make sure that we're getting the prices we need to pay for the claims and not camouflaging that already existing inflation on claims. Now then, what we do is then obviously reprice the book immediately, and that then, however, takes a year to fully be reflected in the portfolio. So you do get the claims inflation hit if you book appropriately and according to actuarial best practices immediately in these changes, and the benefits of the price increases only come in later. So that is not a misinterpretation of economics. That's how it works in conservatively managed CMP portfolio. Now, let me give you the German example on the agencies, just to give you granularity. We do, and I say that with all self-criticism, have had a strongly aging sales force. A lot of our agents are above 45. In some countries, the average age is even around 50. And we were not investing enough in the past to drive recruiting of high-quality agents. And we started more than 3 years ago in Germany to address this and more successfully recruit new agents. And I think we spent more than 60 million on a new recruiting program to bring new high-quality agents on board. We have created a new sales academy in the city of Cologne that has shown to be highly successful. So, for example, our attrition rate on new agents in Germany has significantly been falling over the last 24 months. So this is really important. By the way, replenishing sales force is a hugely expensive exercise. It's very cheap in the short run to suppress investments, very expensive to catch up, and we're doing some of the necessary catch-up investments that we should have done a number of years ago, just to be very clear.
Okay. Just on two things, just come back to both of those, if I may, very briefly. The claims inflation thing you're saying is that's effectively the impact of retrospective changes rather than, you know, the normal run rate inflation coming through. That's what you're referring to, I think, there, it sounds like. That's the case, is it?
Yes. But just to give you the order of magnitude, that's more than, from what I can recollect, more than 2 points on the combined, just on that effect in the short term, right? So this is not small change.
Okay. And then the second thing, it sounds like it's effectively human resource you're investing in on that acquisition expense in particular in Germany. And I note your comment about frustration or disappointment in your expense ratio, but I would also note that was said. That's been said for some quarters by your predecessor too, and I just wonder if there's really, in your mind, clear pathway in the sort of coming quarters, years. I don't know how long, what time horizon that you really see that is something that is not achievable in theory, but actually you can see it occurring, that you see that expense ratio coming under control more.
Yeah, let's talk about strategy and let's take an off course. Let's take sort of a recess for 10 minutes because this is, I think, a fundamentally extremely important item. The first one observation is that we've been telling you and we've been invested a number of years now in bringing our administration expenses down. And despite some of the reclassifications, I'm firmly convinced that we've not just cut headcount and introduce new technology, we're bringing the admin cost down. And I think that is going to happen. And over time, you see an admin cost ratio of below 7%. And we will drive that. And even though it was very difficult and caused some disruption in the core market, we are determined to continue on that path. Is everything said and done? No, it isn't. There are a couple of challenges, and let me mention them, but we're working on them. The first one is that in this industry, and different to other more mature industries, labor still expects positive salary development year on year, regardless of what the top line development is. And we have to deal with that. In other industries, you do not get automatic salary increases of 2 to 3% as you get them in our industry. So we have to manage that. Yeah? In a family business where I come from, if revenues don't move, you don't get a raise. And the issue that we have to address here is factor cost inflation. Now, we're doing this really well on the non-personnel cost, which is about 30 to 35%. But on labor cost, we need to make sure that labor cost inflation works in sync with revenue development. That's the first observation, and that is something we have to address. So, for example, we still sit in a number of high-cost locations in Europe, and we have to move to the periphery where we have lower personnel cost and we have lower cost for non-labor. But this is clearly understood. We've been on this journey, and you see that reflected in the number. The other one, and that is more strategic as an issue, is that the universe in terms of sales architecture and channel architecture is changing. We have 2% of our revenues in P&C coming from car manufacturers today. We're already the market leader. That channel is significantly growing in importance. It's very tough to manage because our global partners do expect global service across the countries, and we are creating a dedicated unit, dedicated manufacturing processes, and that requires investments in the future. We have to revamp our agency channel. For many years, I think this industry overall, it's not just Allianz, has been just milking this channel. And there's a question how you work offline and online, and we're in the middle of the process to determine the new balance, particularly around P&C. The last effect is, and I think, and I just bear with me here, a number of the forecasts were made at the end of 2007 when we were at the absolute peak in terms of earnings in the P&C industry, in terms of productivity increases. We all know that we have had four, depending on how you look at the markets, 5 years of declining prices of declining prices. Now, our prices in motor in Germany, I think, are lower today than they were 5 years ago. And in that environment, it's extremely tough to bring the expense ratio down. Also, just managing against that continuous price decline is already a lot of work. So I understand your concerns also relative to the communication, but this is a very tough environment. And the crisis, on top of that, has issued further pressure because we have had shocks to insurance demand. You see that across, if revenues go down in our clients, a lot of the commercial lines P&C revenues go down as well, but the exposures don't decrease all the time. So that has to be understood, and that is putting additional pressure on this this industry and the segment. And I have to tell you, if we can come out of the soft cycle with a combined ratio of below 97, this is something to be proud of and not to complain about.
Okay, thanks ever so much for that.
We will take our next question from Paul Goodhind from Redburn.
Yes, hello, good afternoon. I've got two questions. The first is on the asset management division, and specifically to try and understand, of the 128 in performance fees, how much of that you sort of gave back via bonuses? And I guess the way of asking the question is, if you didn't have that 128 there, there were no performance fees, how much lower would the cost base be in the first quarter? And what percentage can I use going forward just to model?
Well, I don't think I can tell you that. I can say that right away. We will look that up for you and shoot you an email. I already know from my backup that I cannot reconcile performance fees against income of people because I don't know what this structure is at PIMCO in particular, so we would have to look that up.
Okay. Second question is on the non-life side. And I think you said, Oliver, that the large losses that weren't classified as CATs were about 100 million in the first quarter. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what was
weather-related events last
year? And can you give a comparable figure for the first quarter last year? I'm just trying to sort of take out the non-cat volatility as well to see what the underlying claims were doing.
We last year had almost the same number in the first quarter, which was already very high. We have had two winters now consecutively that were very long and had these extraordinary events. I personally, this is my best guess, this is typically at least double of what you would expect in any year.
So what's driving the, on page 18, the 0.6% drop in the claims ratio from frequency severity? You said that was more severity than frequency.
Yes.
Is that the French lumpy commercial losses dropping out?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. We first, as you remember, last year had a number of very large claims in excess of 5 million. That's this French statistic, more than two dozen. And they have come down quite significantly. That is important. And we also had large claims in other countries. So this is really what is driving here. Frequency is actually, as I said before, it's up because of a lot of accidents in the winter. And we hope that tapers out so that effect should continue to be positive.
Yep, that's great. Thanks.
We will now move to Brian Shea from Merrill Lynch.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask three questions if I could. The first two are very quick, though. First of all, Oliver, and for asset management, you said that the remaining costs for the B units should be $190 million. Could you just clarify, are you talking about the remainder of 2010 or the remaining life over the next, 3 or 5 years that of those B units being outstanding? And then secondly, sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. Let me give me the question, and then I can talk.
Okay. And then secondly, on asset management, you target a cost-income ratio of 65%. For the past three quarters, you've been running well below that. You still target 65%, though, so there's some special effects going on here, abnormally high revenues. Maybe this relates back to Paul's question. Are there revenues that are going more to the bottom line than you'd normally expect in some of your revenue makeup? I'm just wondering why it is you're beating that target so handily, but yet not changing the target.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, this is more of an, hope you'll accept this as more of an open-ended question. Your capital position now is bumping up right against the top end of your historic target of 150% to 170%. Over the past, 6 or 9 months, you and other companies have really My sense has been you've been in capital hoarding mode. You've been attaching little importance to old targets, saying there's so much Solvency II uncertainty out there, we're just going to sit on our capital. I just wonder if you could comment on the developments recently with Solvency II. Do you feel there's been enough development that clarity is emerging? And basically, do you feel any confidence that you actually have excess capital that you could be acting on, or is it still a very, very uncertain world out there?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think a very good question. So, now, the 190 million is the P&L effect. We've created some reserves already, so this is the incremental P&L effect over the five-year period. But what is very important, this is if the OPAT level, i.e. the operating profitability of PIMCO, is at the current level. If it further increases, we obviously have to pay more because it's a multiple of this OPAT number. Right? So if you expect that PIMCO grows and continues to grow, which I wish for, but no reasonable person can really expect, then that number would go up depending on that growth number. And again, Oliver can provide you with some of the sensitivities. Now, the cost-income ratio has the same reason. We've been seeing a bonanza and a flight to quality, particularly, again, in the first quarter because of the insecurity in the sovereign market. So people are looking for first-class asset managers now in fixed income again, and PIMCO is in particular profiting from that. Can we expect that to continue forever? I think we can't. I think we can't, even if I wish for. That's why we're saying we need to be cautious and conservative in terms of what we believe is a sustainable number, because we then otherwise get overpriced on the upside. We don't like to get underpriced as we are, I think, overall, but we also want to get overpriced in asset management. Going forward, it's going to remain volatile given what is happening in markets. Now, moving to the subject of capital. You know, since I started, there are many ways to look at capital. When I came here, we do have a AA rating. We're very strongly capitalized. So I think it's a key asset of Allianz, and has proven, particularly in life and health, as a strong pro for us. I think it's driving customers towards us. So shareholders are benefiting from a strong capital position because it drives customers in our direction. First observation. And by the way, the same is true for our large corporate business, where increasingly people are getting worried about ratings. Second observation is, it's not that we've been hoarding capital. I think we've consecutively increased now dividends. By the way, it's not easy in a co-determined board. And bringing dividends up to, if you think about it correctly, 5.6% dividend yield. Try to show me many other stocks that have provided that. So I don't believe we are sort of not distributing cash to our shareholders. I actually feel very good about what we've been doing recently. And indeed, Solvency II insecurity is still very strong. We'll have to wait for the results of QIS5. And particularly the international groups have to watch what happens around available financial resources and our ability to repatriate excess capital. And I'm nowhere close to a point where I say everything is said and done and let's ship. Now, I'm confident that Allianz will emerge relatively strong in comparison to the competition, but the insecurity is very strong. However, I remain committed, that's not just Oli Bethe here, but also Michael Diekmann. We will not sit on excess capital if we don't need it to support investments or growth. We will then return it back to shareholders.
Okay, thank you.
We will take our next question from Nick Holmes from Nomura.
Yes, hello there. I had a couple of questions. First one is really about accounting definition. I wondered, can you explain to us again why you have a policy of including realized gains in your participating life policies as operating income when you have all of your other realized gains outside operating earnings? I mean, this seems to create volatility to me. Second one is coming back to Solvency II. Could you tell us what you think of the positive view of diversification benefits which the EC has taken? You were saying there's still a lot of insecurity, but I wondered if you're pretty happy about that. Thank you.
Yeah. Let me start with the diversification benefits, and then we'll talk about accounting and how it's being computed. Now, the diversification, I'm very positive because it's a key part. If you sort of look at gross capital and net capital, we do have economic diversification benefits, even though people say in the crisis diversification turned into correlation where it wasn't expected. That is true, and we need to look at that. but we do have diversification across the portfolio. Actually, I believe, and we've been running comparable number, this is a key driver why we've been increasing net retention across the portfolio to the benefit, I think, of shareholders net of reinsurance cost. So that is a big plus. Again, the key item here is going to be, in my mind, not required capital, but AFR, i.e. available financial resources, and how the interpretation thereof. Because, you know, it's very funny, in some groups, the local capitalization is extremely strong. It's also true for Allianz, and then you calculate some virtual numbers, and they show a less strong number that doesn't make any sense economically. So we are hoping for some very clear guidance here.
And Oliver, if I may just follow up, you have insecurity about Solvency II. You mentioned, how insecure are you about the diversification benefits?
We have said that not about the diversification, but about the AFR. It's not, Nick, just without trying to correct you, the key point is on two items. The first one is, if you have local excess capital, how much of that excess capital is actually fungible? How much of that excess capital can you actually move in a crisis on a legal basis and approved by regulators across borders? And how much of that capital is then available for you to use? And these items are not clear yet. There are various interpretations. Yeah, the first directive had a very clear wording, and now people start to interpret that. And there's obviously some local regulators that say, well, the capital I have in my companies in my country is mine. I don't want that to be moved across borders. And that obviously doesn't make any sense from a EU perspective. So we have to see where that plays out, and that is a huge swing. We've said already at our shareholders meeting that can be about 40 to 50% of the solvency ratio. These are huge swings, and we want to make sure that we come out. Again, however, we believe overall we'll be very strongly capitalized relative to the competition, because all international groups are exposed to these issues.
Okay.
Now, let me move, please, to the first question, because it was a good one. This is very important, because we have to have realized gains in the operating profit, as operating profit gains are shared with policyholders, right? So we have the legal obligation to share them with policyholders. Therefore, they need to be in operating. And
yeah,
That's very clear. Otherwise, we run into a legal problem. This is not choice in order to sort of heighten our earnings, and we know that it might add volatility. It's very important that allows us and is required in order to share these profits with our policyholders.
Have you thought of a way of smoothing those gains by taking a normalized return and then showing variations below the operating line, something like that, to avoid volatility?
Actually, if you look at the numbers in detail, I cannot give you a specific number on top of my head, but we've analyzed this for the board. You actually have the vast majority of the realized gains in the operating side to just reflect the nature of the business. I think it's important for shareholders to understand the inherent volatility that you have, even if you're a majority investor in fixed income. Just what the business, I actually think it would be detrimental to put it in non-operating and try to camouflage the effects. That's why, by the way, I think that in a number of countries that exactly has led to life insurance companies being undercapitalized and mismanaged. So we are very comfortable with that, and we are managing in that parameter. By the way, that also provides the appropriate incentives for our asset managers, both internally and externally, to keep volatility under control. So to the opposite, I feel very comfortable with the way we are accounting for it.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll take our next question from Giulio Raffo from Autonomous. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two questions. The first one, I was wondering if you could please quantify for us what do you think the shareholder share of the capital gains on the life segment was. And if I'm not wrong, I think in the past you tend to accrue more bonuses and share of income towards the final quarter. So I was wondering if what you did in Q1. And then the second question is on your 40% payout that you quote in the statement. And, you know, I was wondering, you know, you clearly had 4 points of solvency ratio in Q1. Would you feel confident about lifting that payout through the rest of the year in order not to exceed your 170%, or do you think that would be not prudent considering the uncertainties?
Yeah, thank you for your questions. Julia, on the 40% accrual, we always deduct, as you know, the net income position from our solvency calculation. That is how we do it. We have accrued 600 million in dividend for the first quarter. That is a computation that we always do over the year. That does not predetermine dividend payout. Let me remind you, in Germany, unfortunately, the supervisory board determines the dividend. We can just propose that, and that's co-determined. So there are lots of influences on already the increase this year. You might not congratulate us on that, but that wasn't easy, but we've tried really hard. So that does not is a precursor to any dividend commitment. But as I said before to Brian, we're committed to pay out excess capital above what we need to hold for the business. If we hit the ceiling of 170, then we have to think about what we do with the capital. The opportunity is, as we are growing very strongly, for example, in life and health, to support the growth. This is the first one. The second one is to make sure we have a very conservative risk profile currently. We believe that there are a couple of opportunities out there also on the investment side, so we're debating whether there are investment opportunities that we can use this capital for. So there's lots of stuff out there. For the moment, we start to worry about it when we get there. The first one, the second question was around the life health shareholder share. It was 20% of the total, around 80 million. And if you compute a percentage, then that is 80 million over 538 million. That's 14.8%.
Okay, can we have the next question, please?
We will take our next question from James Quinn from Citigroup.
Yes, hello. Two questions, please. I'm just looking at the two of the segments in the P&C division, ex the natural catastrophe losses. I think reinsurance is a 76% combined ratio and AGCS was 80%. Obviously, I don't want to be sort of selective in picking the ones which look low, but I suppose they do look low, so I'm just wondering, Is that where all the reserve releases are? And just wondering if you could give us an accident year combined ratio for those two segments. And then Oliver, just also in P&C on the top line, I think you seem pretty pleased that you're returning to a sort of growth trajectory again. But if I look down the business units where there's growth, I guess the one that sticks out is reinsurance, which I don't think would be seen as a sort of core strength of Allianz, and you're still shrinking in, I think, what people might look at as the core markets of Germany, France, and Italy. And I'm just wondering, what your thoughts are around that. Clearly, that seems to me a sign that the markets themselves are still very tough and not being particularly disciplined. I mean, what do you see from the perspective of the outlook for your expense ratio? Because it seems to me just as likely that your expense ratio will continue to increase simply because, obviously, if you're going to continue a policy of being pretty disciplined around pricing, it's quite likely you'll continue to lose market share there. But perhaps there are some extenuating circumstances. Thank you.
Yeah, James, very good question. Now, let me answer the fact question first. You asked what the accident year loss ratios were in the first quarter for Allianz Re and AGCS. Allianz Re was 85%. And AGCS was 80.5%. So is not in line with the assumptions. We had some runoff. We had some in Italy because we've had very conservatively reserved over the crisis. Because of the Bersani, our colleagues have been extremely cautious. Yeah, and despite, by the way, this fact, our combined ratio in Italy is much better than the rest of the market. We have the lion's share of the profits in the market, despite the fact that we are only 14%. And we've had runoff in the credit insurance, same effect here. We've had extremely conservative reserving in the crisis, and some of those reserves have proven to be redundant in light of the runoff experience. So there is nothing that is managed here. The second observation you have on reinsurance growth, It's absolutely right. Reinsurance has two components. It's the external reinsurance and the internal reinsurance. That growth came from higher internal cessions. Yeah, so that is not market cession, cannot sort of be said as external growth, but that only reinforces your point around what is happening in the core markets. Yes, and if you say you are losing market share, and there's the whole story around nobody ever shrank to greatness, in a soft cycle, particularly as we're nearing the bottom of the cycle, we are prepared to let volume go in order to maintain positive and even improve margins. In Germany particularly, we have been continuing to cleaning fleets. That is a lot of top line, but the bottom line improvement is even more significant. So the key thing, what we have to achieve, we have to bring the loss ratio down. And that's typically at least two-thirds where we spend our money. So, and if you ask me for the trade-off, yes, I would accept an increasing loss ratio if I have the option, increasing expense ratio, if I have the option to invest in order to bring the loss ratio down, because our point in the last year and a half, in my perspective, has been too high a loss ratio trend-wise. So that is what we have to bring down and make sure that we get the strength that we have in underwriting and claims back to the fore, and that is where we're strong. Now, there are a couple of cyclical points. Let me point out to them. The first one is the combined ratio was affected significantly by credit. You've seen that, very severely hit. Credit is turning a corner. Second, we've had very strong hits in Italy because of the merger and Bersani, and there are significant signs that we finally see price improvements and that the frequency in our portfolio is going down, and particularly also severity is being positively affected. Would I call this a full turnaround yet? No, but I think over the course of the year that should be turning positively. We had in the U.S. a particular impact on expenses from the change in the crop structure and other items, and we have net cat, so that should normalize. And that leaves us then at the end of the day with France and Germany. In France, we had, as we mentioned before, in addition to NetCat, the very large industrial claims last year, which we see disappearing. So that also should provide significant positive momentum on the loss ratio. And then you go back to Germany, and as I said, there the expense ratio is down relative to prior year first quarter, and we have to get better on the loss ratio because that's the core strength of the German operation. So the momentum on the combined should not come from the top line. That's exactly right. It should come from improving losses. That's what the targets for the people are. I don't want to grow where margins are inappropriate.
Okay, perhaps if I could quickly come back on both of those. I mean, firstly, on Allianz Re and AGCS, an 85 and an 80.5% combined ratio looks quite low on an accident year basis. Is there a sort of, one-off type of positive within that, just in terms of the underlying accident year numbers? And just to summarise, I think on the how you improve your combined ratio. I mean, is it fair to say essentially that the expense ratio isn't going to improve, the pricing probably isn't going to be enough to generate improvement. So if there is improvement, it has to come from your own operating efficiencies, effectively.
Yeah, I think it's most importantly is selection. Risk selection is extremely important in claims, where in some areas like France and Germany, we had some distortions in as part of the reorganization. Let's go back to the numbers. The runoff in AGCS was 11.9%. It was only 0.7% negative, i.e. we added to reserves in Allianz Re. But the key thing is technical excellence. This is what has to drive our performance at the bottom of the cycle. That is not sudden price increases somewhere in the market. Now, where we can take price, we will take price. As we said, for example, if motor markets are not available, we are increasing prices in non-motor. We've done that in retail in Germany, for example, and we're doing it in other places. You have the targets for that on page 22.
Right, thank
you. We will take our next question from William Hawkins from KBW.
Hi, thank you very much. Just a couple of questions on your life business, please. Is there any chance you could indicate how much the surplus value of business in force might have moved in the first quarter? I think it might be down a bit, but if you could help quantify, I'd be grateful. And then In your IFRS operating profit, the interest and similar income for the life division, how comfortable are you with the 3.5 billion as a repeatable quarterly number, given that the bond yield continues to fall at the long end? And in that context, finally, the 2.6% new business margin that you're generating, how concerned are you about the sustainability of that number, given that the German bond yield is now below 3%?
Yeah. Actually, the MCEV number in the first quarter well, is up, not down. It's up by half a billion to 24.8 billion. The first one is, the second one is more difficult on the interest and...
I'm sorry, Oliver, I meant the surplus value of business in force, not the MCEV. Is that also up half a billion?
I'm going to look that up in a second. That was the MCEV one that will give you the traditional surplus numbers in a sec. Somebody is going to look that up. New business margin, good question in this interest. There are a couple of things that drive this and how that is being priced. The most important thing that sounds very strange is discipline. We have had in this industry in the past people that tell us we will have launch a new product, and in order to get it on the shelf of, let's say, broker-dealers in the U.S., we'll have to have overruns, particularly on the expense side, and that affecting margins. I'm not accepting that anymore. And, for example, for the U.S., I can report to you very soon there will be no more overruns. And there's also no more capital consumption. This has a lot to do with how you run this business. And many of these parts were run sometime in the past for top line and not for margin. The second one is, what is the composition of the products that you're having across the portfolio? And we're very carefully monitoring what we're doing across the various channels in bank assurance and in our agency force and how we are pricing the options. So I think we have considerably improved the way we are pricing our options and putting them into the product. So we're back with the questions around life. We're still just on the surplus value on the in-force. That's why I couldn't give you the number. It's very simple because we only compute it once a year for year-end numbers. So if we have further questions here, would you be so kind to call IR? We don't have the number now, but we're going to dig something up for you that makes it possible for you to compute whatever you'd like to compute. We were on the margins, and your question was a very good one. How do you feel about your margin, and can you sustain them? I was trying to say the first one is around discipline. Where do we grow? What countries with what products? And where are we in the cycle? So also, let me give you a practical example. We have been taking some guarantees out in markets where we're not getting appropriate returns for that. And a couple of markets, let me give you some markets in Asia where pure unit-linked products are significantly up in terms of volumes and in terms of margins, together with equity markets, and that giving us very good margins at this point in time. Can I forecast for those volumes to continue to come? I cannot. But we have really put in floors that people have to stop selling products if we don't get our target margins. So from my point of view, with the tightening of the controls that we've put in for new product development and reviewing the pricing, I feel very good about that. And the second component is, and I mean it, is we are the most conservative in terms of computing this number. So I don't have a mean reversion assumption built in into these returns and other features that might make these new business margins look terribly good. And then when we have a low interest rate environment continuing, then those margins disappearing. Yeah, and you can, again, go through the details that we have provided on MCEV disclosure and compare that to other companies. You will see that. So this is more I cannot really say around how sustainable they are. If we do continue for a long, long, long time in this low interest rate environment, obviously that will become more difficult over time to sustain. Now, interest and similar income. The one thing I'd like to say is the overall quarterly result. You cannot multiply this number by four. We'd like to stick with the overall guidance that we have. Somebody mentioned earlier, well, you've always really determined the final outcome in the fourth quarter. Is that a change? We have decided, we communicated that to you, that we want to have it more quarterly reflecting the actual income. So we have not had smoothing effect. And we would like to stick with the overall 2010 expected number on operating income of around 14.3 billion. Now, if the asset base continues to build well in excess of the low interest rates repricing in the portfolio, obviously that number can be higher. maybe 200, 300 million, but I don't want to be precise here at this point in time. Is that okay?
We may have lost her, so I think we are ready for the next question.
As a reminder, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1. For your information, there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, wonderful. If there aren't any more questions, then we thank you for having joined our call. We say goodbye to everybody and we wish you a nice remaining afternoon.
Ali, I'm not sure. Do you think we cut off some of the colleagues also? Somebody out there did cut them off? Let's wait another minute or so for maybe people are dialing back in. I don't want to cut anybody off that really wanted to have a question. So last time we were a little short. I'm ready to invest here in additional
Very
time.
Good.
As a reminder, if you wish to ask a question at this time, please press star 1. We will take a follow-up question from Michael Haid from Cheuvreux.
There you go, Michael. We would have
good afternoon.
We would have cut you off and we didn't want to do that.
It's not a follow-up question, in fact. First question is a very simple one. The split between personal lines and fleet business in German Motor and the combined ratio in the fleet business in the first quarter, how high was it? Second question, more a long-term question. You mentioned that with the interest rate environment, in the current interest rate environment, the 2.2% margin is not going to be easy to achieve. Now, with the ECB able and obviously willing to buy the government bonds, or some government bonds, they probably will keep the interest rates low. And I assume this does not make you very happy. To what extent is this a concern for you, and how do you intend to answer to that, especially in German life, maybe?
Yeah. I got a couple of answers to that. Somebody is going to dig up the German Motor number for you now, so that's going to take a couple of seconds. What I would like to say on the margin, to the opposite, by the way, I believe that our margin can be sustained only if we have a sort of a 10-year horizon of very low interest rate is going to get increasingly difficult. So we feel very comfortable that we can maintain the margins. And actually, I think in some areas we can actually further improve. So, for example, I would like to push pure risk products much more aggressively. They give you less top line, but very nice margin. Just to give you an example, and in some markets you can combine life products with accidents and health, and that's what we're trying to grow. Now, by the way, just as an imperin feedback while we're waiting on the number, the overall motor combined is 107.2. The fleet number will and the split I'm going to give you in a second. Now, with a view on the government bond, please don't forget that in addition to government bonds that we hold in Germany, we're investing in covered bonds, which provide a significantly better spreads. Even the spreads on German bonds have been going up, and we're supporting the governments to buy KfW bonds, which also offer nice spreads. So I think there are good investment opportunities out there, and we are earning well in excess of our guaranteed rate. So we feel very comfortable, by the way, in particular in Germany. Now, total motor, as I said, 107 combined. The fleet is at 110.
Okay.
Just to answer your question, so I think we have answered both questions, I hope.
Perfectly. Thank you very much.
As a final reminder, if you wish to ask a question on today's question and answer session, please press star 1 to signal.
So, Oliver, I think we've done your customer service. Guys out there, thank you very much for being with us today. It was a long day probably for all of you.
Yeah.
The Germans amongst you will benefit from a holiday tomorrow. Us others will be on the road and in the office, so have a great evening.
Yes, have a nice day. Cheers and bye-bye.